Okay, I'm going to open up this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Thursday, May 11th, 2017. Colleagues, we've got a few public hearings and then some work sessions. But why don't we just start with the public hearings, especially since we're graced with the presence of Representative Clem.
Yeah. A Marshfield student?
Yeah.
Right. Amazing.
This is problematic, Mr. Chair.
I assume he wants to speak to us about House Bill 2039. So I will open our hearing on House Bill 2039. Beth, you want to say something about it?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2039 would require votes from city electors and those from the area proposed for annexation to be counted separately to determine separate majorities if a territory to be annexed includes more than 100 acres.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, and I represent District 21, which is here where we're sitting, and parts of Salem, and also very relevant to the topic here, an unincorporated area that sits just east of Salem, which is about 10,000 people, roughly, who live out there. And this bill is about island annexations. There are 13 different types of annexations. This one only pertains to island annexations. And island annexations, from my point of view, are for times when there are sort of unintended pockets of people that get created by normal annexation methods. And the problem that presents for service providers is if you have the entire city surrounding three houses and then the sheriff would have to drive through the city to get to those three houses rather than just letting the city police go there, that's a problem. So that's why we have the island annexation law, is normal annexation methods will sometimes create little pockets of things that it is very difficult to let them have veto authority over whether they want to be annexed or not. It just really is hard. So I'm fine with having island annexation law, and sometimes that means people will be annexed when they don't want to be. The issue becomes, should there be a size limit on what those islands are? Or cities could get tempted to make massive islands of people using the island annexation law and then bring them in. So why would they do that? It's the only one where the people in the island don't vote on whether they get to be brought in on their own majority basis of the elections where people vote. So I'll try and make that less confusing. Many cities in Oregon, nobody votes on annexations but the city council. This bill only applies to cities where their charter says everyone's going to vote on all annexations. And there's not that many of them, but there are some, and Salem is one of them. So we vote on every single annexation here. It's in our charter, and we vote on all of them. So in these cases where there is an island and the city people are going to be voting on whether the county residents are brought into the city, currently the city votes, the people on the island vote, and it gets added together, and whoever wins the majority, it's called a combined majority, whoever wins, wins. What this bill would do is say, if it's under 100 acres, the system stays the same. City votes, island votes, add them together, see who wins. If it's over 100 acres, I personally feel like that's not the right method to use for those kind of annexations. There are other ones, for example, a thing called annexation plan, where you could bring everybody in. And using the island to bring in really large amounts of people, I think, is a misuse of the island statute. So this would say in those annexations, in cities where they vote on everything, which is a very limited number in Oregon, the island and the city would be counted separately if it's over 100 acres. So what's the reason for 100 acres? State of Washington doesn't allow any annexations using the island method over 100 acres at all. Period. No annexations over 100 acres in Washington. So I didn't want to go that far because there could be a situation where you need to annex something using the island method. And so in this situation, what I am proposing is it still can be annexed, but you actually have to sell the people in the island that they should be annexed if it's a very large island. All of this is aimed at what I would consider non-voluntary annexations. This is where people don't want to be annexed. They really don't want to be annexed. If they want to be annexed, they will petition the city and say, hey, we have what's called a triple majority annexation. We've got a majority of the electors, a majority of the property value, a majority of the owners. We want to be brought into the city. And developers will do that in order to get their developments ready for growth and get streets and sidewalks and that kind of thing. That's not what we're describing here. We're describing situations where people routinely don't want to be brought into the city. And if a city draws an island around them artificially to put them in the city, they get very angry and upset. And the legislature has acted in the past to stop that. So in 2007, under the tutelage of my former principal and the Ag Committee chair at that time, Senator Roblin, we passed legislation saying cities may not artificially draw roads around areas to create islands. It has to be incidental, where no more than 25% of the island can be made up of a road. Because we did have some cities that were just putting roads all the way around, for example, Nike, and then wanting to annex them by calling them an island. So we did do something for some large entities in Oregon, but we didn't do anything at the time for kind of bigger chunks of just neighborhoods. So that's the point of this bill. Double majorities, only in cities who vote, only if only 100 acres or more. Probably only affects Salem, honestly, to be honest with you, but I didn't want to just write the city of Salem right into
the bill. They wouldn't do that for you.
Yeah.
Senator Roblin.
So if there's two families that live in that 100 acres, or let's say three, that makes it easier, and two of them don't want to come in, that means that 100 acres doesn't come in your bill?
City would vote. The three families would vote. Two out of the three say no, so then the whole annexation of those three houses would fail.
Okay.
The person who wants to come in could just go in the very next day and petition to come in under triple majority annexation, and that would be completely fine with me. It's the island is usually not for the voluntary, it's for the involuntary. Not always, but usually.
How did your bill do in the House? Do you remember?
I feel like I had seven or eight no votes.
I think there were 18.
18.
18.
Oh, sorry. And I think they were almost all from your party.
Yeah, pretty much. Usually it breaks down along whether someone was in local government lines or not. So usually it's not a partisan thing. It's if you were in local government, you don't really like the legislature hamstringing your tools. If you're in local government, or you weren't, you're less respectful of local government. I clearly am not very respectful of local government here.
Wait a second. Is that how your side works? It doesn't work over here this way. Just because we weren't in local government, we don't disrespect them.
I think it's just me, Senator. I'm the disrespectful one. Most people are respectful to everybody except me.
Yeah, I assume these no votes had nothing to do with the bill, and they were all about you.
That would not be uncommon.
Yeah.
You'll hear the other side. Aaron and I have been battling this for 10 years, so it's fine.
Right. So, Brian, if you want to hang around, let's hear from Aaron.
Okay.
Speaking of cities.
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'd like to say that maybe those 18 no votes were because I was very compelling. We are, of course, in opposition to House Bill 2039, basically on the principle that for the 36 cities that do have voting on annexation, should they come across an incident in which they have a 100-acre island, we don't believe that those islands should be able to basically reside within a city and receive the benefits of living in the city without having to pay for the property taxes to cover the services of the city. Oftentimes, when there is an island, we do have mutual aid agreements for emergency response purposes, so it's unlikely that a city cop wouldn't respond in an island just because there's a border there, but we... And then also similarly with the fire, we do collect some resources if we are like providing library services to those islands. Oftentimes we will charge a non-resident for access to the library. But the chances are if someone lives in an island within a city, they're working within the city, they're enjoying the parks that we don't charge access fees for. They have all the benefits of living within the city, but they aren't paying the property taxes. And instead, they're burdening the counties to provide all the rest of the services to them. that we don't have mutual aid agreements on, and the county then has to, you know, make sure that those folks are being serviced while trying to also focus on the more rural areas. The other piece of this that it makes it very difficult to accept a double majority vote, which will essentially give an island the power to veto any annexation, is that at the end of the day, our land use system does sort of require us to annex these areas so that we can do our urban growth process properly, make sure that the infill redevelopment potential of a large island like this is brought to fruition. Generally, you're going to only come across a large developed island because of the way our urban growth boundary process requires us to select land. It says we take the areas that have somewhat urbanized first, so the rural residential areas. Those folks are going to pre-exist the expansion of the urban growth boundary. They're going to more than likely not want to pay additional taxes for some reason. And instead, they're going to be perfectly satisfied with the large property lots that they have, the services that they may or may not receive, and the property tax rate at which they're taxed. But in order to do what we're supposed to do as a city to urbanize an area, we need to be able to control the development process that occurs within that island. We need to be able to do the infill that is expected when we do our needs analysis, building land inventory, and then set up the what our comprehensive plan says should occur in order to provide enough housing or jobs or whatever lands that we have. So by providing the opportunity to just say no to annexation, you're reducing our ability to fulfill our obligations under Senate Bill 100. Which, of course, we already struggle with mightily. I say that from time to time, so I should acknowledge that here. And for that reason, we're really opposed to this bill creating a double majority system, because that double majority voting is too difficult for us to overcome that opposition when folks are truly inside an island. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Roper.
So they could change that by becoming a city, right? Because we do have cities inside of cities. I think there's a person on this.
I represent one.
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, yes, it is possible that an island like that could incorporate. There would be a long incorporation process, which if folks want to read about, we do have a handy guide for. We welcome new cities that choose to become their own administrative bodies. There are a number of cities that are cities that are islands inside a city themselves, particularly in the metro area. It is a possibility if they chose to go a different route, and they would have to then provide for their own services and have a plan for how they would financially support themselves. It's not a simple process. They'd have to work with the county to accomplish that as well, but it can be done.
Okay. Any other questions for Aaron? Brian, is there anything you want to say in response to what Aaron had to say?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Brian Clem, representative from District 21. The only issue I would comment on, well, maybe two. One, I will acknowledge that I largely have the experience of my district and talking to people there, so I can't say that what the experience is in other districts. But when you do talk to people in my district and you talk to them about the subsidy issue, what they typically will say is, look, I pay my county property taxes, which covers the sheriff, and I pay a fee to my rural fire department, which comes to my house, and I really like them. So I pay my share there, and the city of Salem police and fire don't come to my house. It would be theirs. Now, sometimes it works both ways, where if the fire's real close out to the edge, the county will come in and help the city, of course. But it goes the other way, too, where the county fights fire, or the city will fight fires in the county because they don't want to let a house burn down over a jurisdiction issue. The thing they will talk about is often, I'm on a well, I'm on a septic tank, I'm not on city water or sewer, which we've talked about this issue too, and I'm okay if you're connecting to city services that you need to be annexed. But if you're not on anything and what you're doing is things like going to the park or going to the library, which we charge county residents a fee, I just don't feel like they're really being subsidized that much by the city, except maybe the use of the park. So it's an argument, but I don't think it's for people who don't have services from the city, tangible, hard-fixed services. I'm not sure they're really getting subsidized. The other thing is I am, as some of you know, chair of the land use committee in the House, and I am a supporter of the land use system generally. And I would agree that if these areas weren't already largely developed to urban densities, this could really be a big problem for land use planning. But in my district, at least, these neighborhoods are already built to full full density, with the exception of maybe one area called Jan Ray that has some bigger lots. But they're not vacant land that we're leapfrogging over and then creating these weird patchwork situations. It's really more about the subsidy issue and the taxes, at least for Salem. Typically, a developer will actually want, not always, but typically they will want to be brought into the city because it does add value to their project to get streets and sidewalks and lamps and sewers and water. It's usually the people who are in these urban neighborhoods that aren't in the city, but I don't feel like they're hurting the land use system the way it would be if it were bare land that we were just jumping over because no one wants to be have their bare land annexed. And so you got these huge fields all throughout the city that aren't being built on because of these holdout people. That, I think, would be a big problem with land use planning. This is, to me, mostly about are they being subsidized or not, and should they, when they chose to live in the county, be brought in using a method that is meant to only bring in a few people at a time and bring in literally, and I have two islands, each are around 4,000 to 5,000 people, and I feel like this is not the method to use if you want to annex them. You should use the annexation plan method if you want to annex large swaths of people, which is what the city of Bend did. They annexed everybody in their urban growth boundary. I think the problem for the cities is that method was changed by the legislature like 12 or 14 years ago to be a double, it's a double majority. It's also a double majority. The annexation plan has to be the pass in the city and the residents, and so because it gives the island veto authority, I think cities don't want to use that method, but I feel like that's appropriate rather than calling 5,000 people an island. Okay. But it is a different technique. That this is easier, for sure. This is an easier way to annex people.
And if I may, Chair, I think we've discussed how difficult annexation already is as a process in a previous hearing that affected the same 36 cities, ironically. And if there is an opportunity to take a look at overall annexation policy and how it better could fit with the land use process, that is also something that we would welcome. It was tried, I think, well before my time, so sure, why not? I can try it too. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that offer.
Great.
I think you would think that if they were in the urban growth boundary, then they are automatically annexed when you want them.
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I think that would be a policy decision. It would make cities' annexation decisions easier, yes, but that is a policy decision that this body would have to make.
I agree.
And would it be fair to say that the primary point of resistance to being annexed is the tax, higher taxes that you would pay? Is that what is the prime motivator?
Mr. Chair, I think that is definitely part of it, but it also has to do sometimes with culture of, like, I had a lot of people complaining that they would no longer be able to have a farm, pets, or animals on their property. They're in the UGB, but in the county you're still allowed to have your 4-H llama, and in the city you're not. And sometimes about where you can park your RV, cities, you can't just put it out in the street. County, they don't pay, they don't care. So it's half taxes, half I don't want the city telling me how to live.
And Chair Dembro, there are a few other things. Sometimes it's about where you get your services from and being, you know, feeling like you get your services from the service provider that you prefer, as opposed to turning into the city and having to learn a whole new city system. So there are a lot of reasons why people might resist annexation, but I do find that property taxes is at the top of the list.
Okay, thank you both. Is there anybody else who wanted to speak on 2039? Seeing not, I'll close our public hearing on House Bill 2039 and open our public hearing on House Bill 2785. And we have Dave Honeycutt, Jesse Bounds, I'm sorry, Jesse Bounds, and Marianne Nash.
No, it's very specific.
Jesse someone.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like Bounds now, but it's Bounds, huh?
Bounds.
Yeah. Beth, could you tell us what this...
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2785 would create an exemption from the removal fill permitting requirements for certain activities related to dwellings, ag buildings, or activities associated with those buildings if they've received county approval and are located on the same lot. The provisions would apply to a use established on or before January 1, 2017 on land zoned for exclusive farm use, forest use, or mixed farm and forest use.
Okay. Dave, you're going to
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 2785A. This bill came out of Representative Clem's committee on a unanimous vote and off the House floor on a unanimous vote. The idea, as the committee is aware, the Department of State Lands exercises jurisdiction over wetlands. And wetlands, there's a broad definition for wetland. I think we can all conjure up an image in our mind of you know, what a wetland, a pond or something with standing water, and think, okay, yeah, we can all agree that that's a wetland. But there are also areas that DSL would exercise jurisdiction on that if we looked at it, especially if it was, say, in August or September, we'd go out and look at it and think, well, I don't know if this is a wetland. I don't think it is. And that's the problem. That's a problem that that we haven't figured out a good answer for. We have three levels of maps of wetlands. We have what's known as the National Wetlands Inventory. That's a federal government map showing wetlands. We have a state wetlands inventory that I believe DSL is responsible for. And then there are a number of communities, I think it's primarily cities, that have local wetlands inventories. And so if a property owner goes to submit a land use application to do something on their property, or they go to buy a piece of property and they go to the county and say, okay, well, are there any wetlands on the property? The county may look at the local wetlands inventory. If there is one, they'll look at the state wetlands inventory and the national wetlands inventory. And if there aren't any wetlands showing on those maps, then as far as the property owner knows, their land is free of wetlands. The difficulty is, as DSL will tell you, that just because you're not on the wetlands inventory map does not necessarily mean that you don't have wetlands on your property. That's the problem that that Mr. Bounds encountered. What this bill does is there are a series of exemptions from DSL's wetlands removal fill authority, exemptions that would not require you to obtain a fill permit from DSL before you engaged in some kind of use on your property. This bill would add an additional subsection to that statute, 196.905, to provide that a property owner who received all of the local permits to make a land use on their property and did so before January 1, 2017, for either a dwelling or some type of agricultural use on their an ag building or an ag use on their property prior to January 1 of 2017 is exempt from the removal fill requirements. Essentially, what we're trying to do is grandfather in the folks that have, in good faith, made a use of their property, received all their local permits, and then found out at some point after the fact that there may be wetlands on their property. That's all the bill does. Mr. Bounds, again, sitting to my left, will explain his situation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Dave. Mr. Bounds, welcome.
Chair Denbrough, committee, thank you. Dave basically summed it up. I went to the county.
Your name.
Oh, yeah. Jesse Bounds, sorry. I went to the county and applied for our building permits for our ag buildings. And there was no wetlands found on the property. Last summer, we had a fire and the buildings burned. And I got a letter from DSL afterwards stating that there was possible wetlands on the property. And we met with DSL. And their determination was basically off of a soil map. And then I contacted Val to talk to her about how we can handle this. And that's basically what happened. I talked to the county after DSL contacted me, and they said, well, what's the problem? There's no wetlands on the inventory maps. And basically that's the problem, is the process.
How much was mitigation?
DSL said that they were going to call my whole property that had any hydric soil wetland. So there's like over 12 acres. So mitigation would have been $57,000 an acre for 12 acres. So,
okay, no, thank you. Thank you. And we'll have some questions for you,
sure.
Mr. Bounds. Yes.
Chair Dunbar, members of the committee, Marianne Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. And yeah, we got involved in this case because we know of Mr. Bounds and other farmers that are in similar situations that approached the county, got all their necessary approvals and necessary permits, looked at the maps and said, okay, I'm good to go, I'm going to build, and are potentially subject to DSL enforcement because they didn't know. And one of the big issues for me is that, you know, the counties don't have it on the map, and that's usually what triggers them sending it up to DSL. It is a longer-term problem. It's one we need to be looking for a solution for. But in the immediate term, I think for us, the best answer is making sure that the folks that have already done the work in good faith, made the investment in good faith, and kind of got caught in the middle of a rock and a hard place are grandfathered in and able to go forward. And then we can, as the next step, look forward to what potential longer-term solutions might be. So, yeah, this bill is supported by Farm Bureau and Oregon City Council, and I think we think it'll be a good fix for a lot of our farmers, particularly in the Valley.
Great. Jesse, Mr. Bounds, so your intention is to rebuild using roughly the same footprint?
Sure, yeah.
Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Downs, so I take it you had a building, it burnt down. You went to rebuild it, you got the permits from the county, and then DSL said, oh, no, it's on wetlands. Is that the story?
Yes, the story.
I think it's maybe more complicated than that, actually.
A little bit more.
I think they went by definition of wetland instead of maps is what I think they DSL did.
Yeah, they go off a soil hydric soil map.
So I feel your pain. I've had some very bad experiences with that agency, and I think we're on the right track, and so I understand exactly what you're going
and through. And there is upland soil on my property. We know that. So for them to just assume, they're just going to assume that it's all wetland. And the county maps show it's upland. So that's where this longer process that needs to happen is. There's more to it, but this is what happened in my case. So.
Yeah. I'll just say, I mean, to be fair to DSL, in this case at least, Senator, I think they've been very cooperative on this issue. And they understand the problem and want to rectify it. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Jesse, maybe you should give a little bit more information. I know the area, I bike out there. And so one of the questions I have, I know that there's a temporary structure that's been put up off of, that would be Dorsey Road, if I'm not mistaken. No, it'd be above that because you're at Ferguson on Hubert Lake Road.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so is that part of your property where that?
Yeah. Yeah, so we had on that part of my property is the only – so after the fire, we were short storage. So we started making – our barns burned. So luckily I was able to rent some barns in the valley, in the Willamette Valley, some straw storage barns. But we couldn't store in our location, so we went and stored stacked in fields. One was actually off a high pass. We made some big stacks, and then we had to move them again. We rented all the storage we could find. We were trucking straw from Eugene basically to Salem to store it. Now we're having to truck it back. So that area was the only area that I had that wasn't hydric soil. So I had to make an area to stack some straw. So I contacted DSL. They asked me to have my wetland consultant come out. We looked at that area to make sure that I wasn't going to disturb anything. And that's the only other area that I had that I could make an area to stack straw after the fire.
So where the fire was off on Ferguson's
right.
side, that's the area that's now
right.
in contention.
Right, not where you're talking. That's
right. That was new. I knew that came in. I figured that it was just temporary.
Yes, it is.
What you're trying to
yeah.
do. So I guess if I can ask Dave, and I guess DSL is going to come up and testify too.
Only if we need them.
Well, I'd like to have some information just, and I feel where you're at, Jesse, but this thing about honorary for. I'm just trying to figure out how many properties, what are we looking at? Are we getting ready to open up some type of can of worms? We're not sure what that might mean in the sense of how much property could be captured under the current framework that's of the bill.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Senator Brzezinski, I can tell you that the bill is limited by its terms to exclusive farm use and forest zones. To give you an exact answer, I don't think anyone can tell you because we don't really know. We know what's on the maps, but as the department will tell you, their maps are incomplete. And so coming up with the only way you can tell, short if you're not on the map, the only way you would know is to do a wetlands delineation, a formal delineation. And most people that are building a single family dwelling or engaged in agricultural practice like Mr. Bounds are not going to do a formal wetlands delineation before they assume that if the county says it's okay and I get all my permits and I follow all the laws, then I'm okay.
And just to clarify, so, you know, if Mr. Bounds were wanting to exceed the current footprint, this bill would not give him immunity for that additional expansion.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right, so let me just ask for clarification on that. So anyone that potentially could be impacted by this would be limited by the footprint they currently have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that makes me feel a lot more comfortable as compared to opening up a door that, because I've worked on, and Dave and I've been on the infill stuff, and I know there's a lot of historical properties out there that are, you know, we still don't know everything.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, it's retro.
I may ask DSL to come up just to confirm that, but Mary Ann, were you going to say?
Yeah, so Chair Member Senator Pruzanski, a couple of things we did to kind of also address issues of cases that DSL was already working on. As it says, unless otherwise provided in a proposed order or final order, so it's not like people are going to come and ask for their money back from DSL or anything if they've already settled their cases. And it is, yeah, retroactive to folks that already had kind of existing buildings and existing permits. And so for Jesse looking to rebuild, he could rebuild his existing building because he has the permit to do so and he's authorized. But the intent was specifically not to allow any new uses, but to limit it to kind of what's already out there so that folks that are already out there and have already done work can have some certainty without opening the floodgates to a bunch of new development or a bunch of new folks trying to take advantage of it, because we recognize that we need a longer-term solution, but if we're looking forward, it's maybe going to have to look a little different.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
So the only, clarification I need, looking at just the summary, it does have the word in there for establishment. Then it says repair, restoration, or replacement, and I guess my concern is seeing establishment tells me something potentially new as compared to replacing. So, I mean, that's why I'm asking these questions. It seems like it may be broader than what we intend. Understanding where Jesse and his family's at, that's one thing, but, you know, I don't want to open up this thing that all of a sudden anyone that has land is going to somehow be able to circumvent whatever else we have in place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pruzanski, I think the word establishment is there for someone that had a permit that has not yet exercised the development rights under that permit.
I will say, this is going to add a little confusion, but Chair Member Senator Pruzanski, I actually read that to mean, because DSL, I mean, if you had your house up for 3 years, DSL could come back and say, you know, this was jurisdictional, you have to give us mitigation or you have to tear your house down. And so I read it as the establishment at the time it was permitted. And so, you know, they had established their house, it is there, they're grandfathered in, because DSL can come back and say, you shouldn't have done this, even if it's been there for a while. I know there's some probably statute of limitations on it, but I assume it's less than 2 years. So if you have somebody that, you know, built their house 2 years ago, DSL could come along today and say, you owe us mitigation and you have to tear your house down. If they were driving and saw and said, hey, that wasn't there, I remember that place. And so, you know, I think it depends on how, but to me, the applicable part is if the use was established as of January 1, 2017. And for Jesse, it had the established barn when DSL, you know, it burned down, they tried to rebuild, DSL came to enforce. And so this is saying, okay, you can repair what was an established use that was what DSL came after. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but.
Yeah, it is qualified by if its use was established on or before January 1st, 2017.
And Mr. Chair.
Murky.
I would like to, I know we're not working the bill today, but let's get it out there and figure out what we might need to do to make certain we're all on the same page and that we're not going to make it something that we didn't intend to.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, all three.
Thank you.
DSL, you want to come up?
Chair Dembo, committee. For the record, my name is Eric Metz, Department of State Lands.
So, Eric, your understanding, the agency's understanding of this is that this applies to only to operations on an existing footprint. So, an existing meaning existing as of January 1st, 2017. So any expansion after that would not have immunity under this bill, but would require, one to go through the removal fill process.
Yeah, Chair Dembo, members, that's correct. This, as we understand it, grandfathers only those fills placed on or before January 1 of 17 that were approved by the county and the other qualifications.
Yes, Senator Bertrand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Approved by the counties, well, there's probably a lot of historic fills in the state that have never been approved by the county because it was such a long time ago. Would it encompass those fills too?
Senator Bershinger, my understanding from the bill is that it had to have been established, as was discussed earlier, and it had to have been a building or activity associated with the dwelling, have county approval, and be located in the same lot or parcel as the dwelling or agricultural building. So those are the restrictions. And if your question is hypothetically, let's say there was some fill that didn't meet all those requirements, my understanding is that that wouldn't qualify for the grandfathering.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
So if we had a barn built in the 20s and then it burned down and you went to rebuild it, since it was never approved by the county because it didn't approve barns back in the 20s, so the individual would not be able to rebuild that barn?
Chair Dembo, Senator Bershinger, it's not that they wouldn't be... It was not they couldn't rebuild the barn. It would if they were going to be working in jurisdictional waters that were not subject to the grandfathering clause, and those were confirmed to be jurisdictional waters, then they might require authorization to do that work. Doesn't mean they couldn't do the work.
Mr. Chair, I think I agree with Senator Przanski that we better take a little look at this.
Yeah, I mean, it does say in the bill that one of the qualifiers is that it needs to have received county approval if necessary under, and there are a couple of ORSs, and I guess the question is, we'd have to look at those statutes to see, do they exempt existing historical kinds of operations? Yeah. We can take a look at that.
My reading of that, without looking at that, I would assume they probably did capture that in the sense of those that were pre-regulatory approval. But I would like to have some type of clarification, because if it's an establishment, and what Dave Honeycutt was saying is that if it's someone has a permit and they haven't acted on it, I just like a little bit more information as what does that mean. I mean, I'm not sure how long someone can sit on the permit, you know, how many years, and they haven't taken any steps to act on it, and then they want to, and this may be such an isolated situation, you know, we're wasting time talking about it, but it just seems like we need to have a little bit more before we bring it back for work session.
Yeah, no, I think that's fine. And we'll check with LC on it, the drafter. Okay, thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else want to speak to this bill? Okay, seeing not, I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2785A and open our final public hearing that's on House Bill 2968A. And can we have David Ashton, please, and Bruce Gillis come up? Yes? Or Abby, are you? Okay, great. And as they're coming up... Beth, you want to tell us what this is?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2968 would require the Department of Environmental Quality to study and propose legislation creating a pilot program in which voluntary actions by a property owner to remediate or remove hazardous waste from their property would remove state and federal liability from that property owner. Members, Representative Buehler wasn't able to be here today, so I have a letter from him for you.
Thank you. Okay, who wants to start? Okay.
Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Abby Badouris. I'm a legislative analyst with the Department of Environmental Quality. And to provide some context for the bill today, Bruce Gillis and I from DEQ are here to just give a brief overview of the environmental cleanup program at DEQ and, of course, answer any questions you might have. DEQ administers what's called the Oregon Removal and Remedial Action Law, which is the state cleanup law, which is similar to the federal CERCLA or Superfund law. The program was created in 1987, and it has evolved over the years. DEQ now helps accomplish cleanup and redevelopment of contaminated properties statewide through a variety of approaches, or what we like to call the toolbox. For contaminated property cleanup and redevelopment. And we have mandatory, we have voluntary, and independent programs and some incentive programs. Just highlight a couple of them and then turn it to Bruce. And in 1995, the legislature added a new tool to the toolbox to facilitate the transaction of contaminated properties and help what we call prospective purchasers manage risk in acquiring property. A qualifying purchaser can enter negotiations with DEQ and obtain a limited release from liability in exchange for substantial public benefit. We've entered into nearly 200 of these. We call them PPAs, or prospective purchaser agreements, in the past two decades. More recently, in 2015, the legislature created another tool, and that was in House Bill 2734. And that allowed local governments to create land banks to facilitate acquisition, cleanup, and redevelopment of contaminated sites. And then just last year, the legislature created another tool through the passage of House Bill 4084 to allow for a local option for property tax incentives to encourage brownfield development and cleanup. And now this one would require us to take an in-depth look at ways to coordinate meeting state and federal requirements for liability relief. And I'll turn it to Bruce.
Great. Thanks, Abby.
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, I am Bruce Gillis, and I manage the Environmental Cleanup Program for the Department of Environmental Quality. I've worked for DEQ in the cleanup program now for nearly 30 years. I'm here to provide some explanation about our current processes that we employ in the cleanup program that provide a release from liability and offer recommendations on the scope of any study enacted through this legislation. The bill under consideration today requires a more in-depth look at our cleanup procedures and endpoints, including exploring ways to coordinate meeting state and federal requirements and providing liability relief. DEQ would like to mention 4 points that may be useful to you in your consideration of this bill. First, in the state of Oregon, there's at least 13,000 properties that are known to be contaminated or may be contaminated, including about 5,400 sites that are primarily hazardous substance sites, and nearly 8,000 sites that are underground storage tank facilities that are also under federal regulation. There are currently 14 of the 5,400 cleanup sites on the national priority list, which is being handled under the federal law by EPA, and a lesser number of facilities under our RCRA program. And the vast majority of the remaining sites are being handled under state law by DEQ. There are very few sites where both federal and state involvement under the cleanup provisions of CERCLA or Superfund, the hazardous waste provisions of RCRA, or the toxic substance provisions of TSCA authorities. In some alone, DEQ manages the great majority of the sites in Oregon. Second, DEQ has been implementing a voluntary cleanup program now for nearly 25 years and operating under a one cleanup model for at least 10 years. The cleanup program oversees hazardous waste corrective action sites under RCRA in our cleanup program, along with solid waste landfill corrective action. Pursuant to EPA delegation of corrective action authority to the state. The lone exception of delegation of authority relates to the toxic substances under TSCA, and we have successfully coordinated with EPA on TSCA requirements on the disposal of contaminated waste at our cleanup sites. Third, DEQ has the authority under existing law to provide protection of liability to both responsible parties under ORS 465-325 through settlement with public interests and accomplished cleanup, and with prospective purchasers under ORS 465-327 through agreements, orders, and judgments when liability releases is justified in exchange for a public benefit, which may include cleanup, funds for cleanup, redevelopment, or any important public purpose. Finally, fourth, DEQ cleanup rules specify that DEQ use EPA criteria for risk assessments. The risk-based concentrations that DEQ employs are consistent with the criteria that EPA uses in the most part. Because of this consistency, Oregon has not had issues with EPA second-guessing state cleanup decisions on sites where cleanup occurring under state law rather than federal law, i.e. non-priority NPL sites. DEQ has successfully managed sites on the NPL, which are led by potentially responsible parties. And for the most part, DEQ and EPA have successfully worked together on NPL sites over these years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks a lot. Okay, David?
Good afternoon, and Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is David Ashton. I'm Assistant General Counsel with the Port of Portland, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2968. The Port is of the view that a single coordinated process for parties to satisfy both federal and state cleanup requirements, combined with a broad release of liability at the end of the process, is definitely something that would facilitate brownfields redevelopment and in terms of that toolbox, add an additional tool to the toolbox to help get sites cleaned up. The Port believes that working on reconciliation and streamlining of processes and procedures across these various and sometimes confusing cleanup programs at the state and federal level, while maintaining the protective cleanup levels that are out there, is definitely worth the resources of study, reporting to the legislature, and potential legislative action in the future. As Pennsylvania and EPA Region 4 have demonstrated through their One Cleanup program effort, there are existing federal tools that, when combined with state law liability release mechanisms, can be used to basically get sites cleaned up under one program and give the parties involved in cleaning up and redeveloping the sites the benefit of liability protection. Those parties are the owner who may be doing the cleanup, the developer, the future tenants on the site, and public entities who may have to take an easement or right of way over the property, who may be very concerned about taking that interest in a contamination site. I've provided a little bit more detail in my written testimony on the One Cleanup program. Happy to answer any other questions about that. How does this help enhance the development of Oregon's brownfields? We believe that a single coordinated program with a broad release of liability at the end of it could help in these ways. We think that it could help reduce the front-end transaction costs that are incurred in relation to these sites and thereby get the sites cleaned up faster. So the upfront transaction costs are often a major impediment for a developer to get involved in a brownfield site. Secondly, we think that the existing and frankly wonderful PPA program, the Protective Purchase Agreement program that is run by DEQ, could be enhanced with them broadening ultimately the release of liability that comes with that particular program. We think that the study could also help us look at ways to ensure more deferral of sites of federal interest from the federal realm to the state realm, and thereby we think get them cleaned up and back into productive use much faster. At the Port Authority level, we think that it would definitely help us get sites cleaned up faster and facilitate resolving the various issues we have with parties like public utilities who are extremely fearful of taking a right-of-way or an easement across a contamination site, being very worried that they'll be exposed to unknown liabilities of unknown potential cost to them. And that has definitely held us up on the number of sites in the areas that we work. So we think that the study that would focus on ways to basically streamline and reconcile the processes, but leave the substance of the cleanup standards completely intact, is warranted, and you might look at it in terms of ways to work smarter to get to the cleanup objectives without modifying the cleanup objectives. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. Happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ashton. So let me ask the first question. First of all, I very much support this effort. I see that the bill has a minimal fiscal, and yet the study will incur some cost, I would think. In his written testimony, Rep. Bueller suggested that there was going to be some private support for this effort. Abby, can you tell us about that?
So thank you, Chair Denbrough. In speaking with Representative Bueller, this is his bill, obviously. His understanding on how we should accomplish it would be to work with what we call the Brownfields Coalition, which David, the port's involved with, and many others, as well as private parties, and that although it would be led by DEQ, there would be significant work done with support of both the private and public interest in the coalition. So it is work that we do not have funding for. We would be eking it out and working in cooperation with the coalition.
Great, thank you. Any questions, comments? Okay, all right, thanks for your work on this. Get this scheduled for a work session sometime soon. Okay, with that, I will close our public hearing on House Bill 2968. And colleagues, we have 3, 4, 5. All right, we're going to have a very productive day. We have 5 work sessions. I'm going to save some paper here, Vice Chair.
Cool.
Okay, so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2030A. Vice Chair.
Chair Dimmer, I move House Bill 2030A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2030A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And so what is this one?
Black Bear.
Oh, the Black Bear. Great. Okay, any discussion of this? And this has to do with the non-resident permits.
I'm just happy there aren't any raccoons. We'd have to be together and have to fight off the other people, but it's good.
Is there any objection to the motion? Okay. Seeing none, House Bill 2030A passes to the floor. Senator Bertrager, you want to take this?
Sure.
One? Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2030A. Open a work session on House Bill 2499.
Not doing this one. It's Roblin's. Chair Denver, I move House Bill 2499 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2499 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And this is the one about the fishing vessel permits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any discussion of this, colleagues? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion carries. This will go to the floor and be carried by Senator Roblin.
Yep.
close the work session on House Bill 2499. Open our work session on House Bill 2516.
Chair Dember, I move House Bill 2516 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2516 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? This is one about the abandoned cemetery cleanup.
Yep.
Is there any objection to this bill? Okay. Motion carries. Anybody want to carry this?
I'll do it.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson will carry this one to the floor. Close the work session on House Bill 2516. And open a work session on House Bill 3147.
Chair Dember, I move House Bill 3147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 3147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This is the one about the Hatchery Research Center Board members. Need for consultation. Any objection to this? Any discussion? I'm sorry. Is there any objection? Okay, motion carries. This bill will go to the floor. Senator Roblin will carry it. Close our work session on House Bill 3147. And our last work session is on House Bill 3158A.
Chair Dember, I move House Bill 3158A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 3158A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And this is the one about poaching.
Snitching.
Snitching, poaching.
Right.
Yeah.
Poaching age? Poach. It's what you do with eggs, yeah.
It has to do with rats, but rats are not the victims here. Okay. Any discussion of this? Is there any objection to our passing this bill to the floor? Seeing none, the motion carries.
I'll take it.
Senator Przanski will carry this to the floor. Okay, with that, I'll close our work session on House Bill 3158. And colleagues, that completes our work for this week. Have a great weekend.
Do I have anything tomorrow?
We are adjourned. We are adjourned.
What are we going to do with 2056?
Tomorrow?